Coming up, we got Tom Haverstraw talking about a big, big night in the NBA. Jokic dropping 55, Steph Curry dropping 46, Alex Saar 25, and who some of the other silver linings are for some of the worst teams in the league. Nico Harrison getting fired, Draymond Green going at me. We got into a bunch with Tom. And then later in the show, Field Yates coming on to talk a little bit of the NFL because my Patriots got a big, big game tonight. That's all coming up right now. All right, let's talk some NBA. Joining me today, Tom Haverstraw. Tom, how are you?
Doing great, man. How are you, Kev?
I'm doing excellent, man. It was a fun night in the NBA. Jokic, 55 points in a Nuggets win over the Clippers. I love the Ty Lue quote after the game when talking about the game plan against Jokic. You know, we were playing single coverage. We wanted to force him to be a scorer. I didn't think he would score 55. And Jokic just made it look easy the whole night, Tom. It was nuts.
Yeah, I mean, we need to have a conversation of whether he's the greatest offensive player we've ever seen pick up a basketball.
He sure looked like it last night, for sure.
He's looked like it for the last 6 years. This isn't just one blip.
But he keeps getting better and better, Tom. It's crazy. How does he keep getting better? Already the best player in the world, and he gets better.
He did it to Zoo last night. Yeah. It's not like he was going against the Wizards. This was Zoo was one of the best defensive players of the year last year. And yeah, the Clippers have had their struggles, but what he was doing inside and out, passing, running the floor, shooting, finishing around the basket. I mean, running in transition and dunking with two hands. Who is this guy? He has no flaws, Kevin. If you look at the numbers, they're absurd this season. He's leading the league in assists per game. He's leading the league in rebounds per game. He's right now shooting 78% on twos. 78, Kev! And he's shooting, oh, by the way, 42% on threes. And this game, he scored 52 points in three quarters, Kev. Like, this is the apex of Nikola Jokic, and it feels like we're not really covering this in the appropriate manner. Like, this is what we're seeing right now is pinnacle basketball. We've never seen a big man own the game like this on one end of the floor. It's simply astonishing what Jokic is doing right now.
I mean, it's hard to fathom, really, that Jokic, it's three-time MVP, a champion. Now, at this point of his career, he is 30 years old. At this point, he's playing the best basketball of his life. He turns 31 in February, and it feels like he continues to get better every year of his career in some way. And at this point, I think he also has, on paper, the best overall roster of his career. Steve Jones from the Dunker Spot posted a clip from the game where it was like showing Jokic's numbers. I think it was after three quarters when he had the 52 points, as you said. And then like the graphic moves off screen, it flips to Jonas Valanciunas hitting a post up. It's like he has the best backup center of his career. The supporting cast is excellent, and Jokic is better than ever as well. And I just feel privileged to watch this guy. Because as you said, he is, at least in my lifetime, the greatest offensive player that I've ever seen. He has literally no holes. There are no holes. He's an elite three-point shooter, elite post player, elite offensive rebounder, elite decision maker, elite post player, elite at attacking from a face-up position, elite at literally everything except he doesn't finish lob dunks. But that's about it. He doesn't need it.
Yeah, Kev, like in this game, he had everything going. And you wonder at this point with Nikola Jokic, like, is there a hole in his game, period? Because you look at the passing, the rebounding, the running up the floor. Did I forget to mention he's shooting 87%? Wait, 87% in the restricted area and 82% on middies this year.
It doesn't make any sense.
He's 9 of 11 on middies, on mid-range jumpers. There's no hole in his game, right? So let's just talk about this for a second. You mentioned that the supporting cast is even better than it has been. Let's remind the folks that he's never played with a Luka. He's never played with an all-star player. He's never played with an all-NBA player. Aaron Gordon and Jamal Murray, really good players. They've never gotten a vote for all-NBA in their entire careers. Just imagine if Jokic had a co-pilot that was also a perennial all-star or all-NBA player. LeBron has had that. Steph Curry has had that. Michael Jordan has had that. Magic, Kareem, Wilt, they've all had Hall of Famers next to them. Jokic has never had an All-Star or an All-NBA vote-getter, a single vote for All-NBA next to him. And so I think this is such a unique case with Nikola Jokic. We've never seen an all-time great like this, someone who's on the Mount Rushmore, GOAT status, like in that conversation, but has never had a co-pilot ever. And so I think we have to like recalibrate what we're seeing with Jokic, because he's doing this where Cam Johnson left early in this game and Christian Brown left early in this game, and he still dominated the Clippers that needed a win.
You know, I'll tell you what, Tom, I don't know if he's going to get named an All-Star this year, because it's only 24 spots and they're doing the funky thing this year with the two American teams and then the one world team and all that, the new system this year, which we'll touch on a little bit later. But Aaron Gordon, through 10 games so far this year, not on top of the elite defense, averaging 19.6 points per game on 50-40-90, 53.3% from the field, 45.1% from three, 90% from the free throw line. He's been an all-star caliber player this year. Aaron Gordon, now at age 30, playing the best basketball of his entire life as well. And so you're right, everything you said about Jokic in the past, but some of these other guys alongside him are growing. And Aaron Gordon suddenly becoming last year a very good shooter, after really being up and down throughout his entire career. Very good last year from three, great last year. Now he's amazing as a shooter. He upped the volume, and he's even hitting more free throws this year. So I'd say Aaron Gordon deserves all-star consideration if you voters, when it comes time, the coaches choosing the backups are factoring in defense on top of his excellent offense. So the Nuggets look like a very complete basketball team, as we're hitting on here. The Clippers on the other side of this, they just continue to look old, Tom. And this is a team that entered with high expectations this season. They're only 3-8 on the year. They've lost six in a row. Kawhi Leonard has not played recently. And now we get news that Bradley Beal is out for the season because of a fractured hip. And he was playing like he had a fractured hip, so really no surprise here at this point. But boy, Norm Powell playing better basketball than ever now with Miami. They replaced him with Brad Beal, who I thought could be an upgrade considering what Beal was just last year, even in his diminished state compared to his prime. Well, no, not so much. This is a severe, severe downgrade for the Clippers, and I don't feel any too good at all about this Clippers team moving forward, Tom, at one bit.
I guess you could talk yourself into Chris Dunn. Getting Chris Dunn more minutes will help the defense and help the transition defense, which was an abomination this past on Wednesday night against the Nuggets. Jokic had more fast break points than the Clippers. Okay.
Wow.
Nikola Jokic had more fast breaks. He had six fast break points, and the Clippers had four. Okay. And the FUCK t-shirt that Jeff Van Gundy created has done nothing to help in that department. It hasn't
that was
done
so
anything.
Cheesy. That was like the most old guy thing ever. It's so cheesy.
wasn't it one of the complaints was about Denver transition defense, and they against the Denver Nuggets last night on Wednesday night, they got killed in transition. And so it's just, you know, I don't know what's going to save this Clippers team. They entered the year as the oldest team in NBA history projected to be. And of course, now with Bradley Beal out for the season with the hip fracture, it really underscores how much this team rides on Kawhi Leonard and James Harden, which is a problem because Kawhi Leonard misses about half his games. So this is everything falls on the shoulders defensively on Zoo and Chris Dunn, Derek Jones Jr. These guys need to do better defensively, getting back in transition against a Denver Nuggets team. They got destroyed. Bradley Beal, it's just been bad luck all around the last few years. You know, he goes over in the trade to Phoenix, and then things fall apart in year two of that partnership with Devin Booker and Kevin Durant, and they got to blow that up. And I wonder how much closer we are to the Clippers using the first round picks that they have at their disposal to try to trade to upgrade their wing position or their four position, because they need help in the worst way. They're 3-8. Bradley Beal's gone for the season. They don't have Norm Powell anymore, who's been an absolute stud over there in Miami in their new flow offense. And Bradley Beal, what a weird career, right? Like, you're looking at a guy who's a two-time 30-point scorer, average scorer, in the NBA. There's only 23 teams. I'm going to say that again. Bradley Beal has twice averaged 30 points a game, Kevin. There's only 23 players in NBA history who have done that. Multiple seasons of averaging over 30 points a game. He hasn't been able to put it together in a deep postseason run. He's not a guy who's been all-NBA, multiple all-NBA, but like this Bradley Beal early in his career, it didn't look like he was able to get over those stress fractures that were really plaguing him in his legs early in his career. And then suddenly he puts it together and becomes one of the premier scorers in the league. And it would be a really sad way to end things here if the no trade clause became like his nickname in the second half of his career with Phoenix. And then with the hip surgery here, it's a really sad way for Bradley Beal to go into his mid-30s here, going with, you know, two really tough seasons with the Phoenix Suns and, of course, now with the LA Clippers. I hope this isn't it for Bradley Beal, but considering his injury history, it's going to be a really tough uphill climb for him to get back to being a real contributor for a contender now.
Well, I mean, too bad for Beal, too bad for the Clippers. They're 3-8, and guess what? The Thunder have their first-round pick.
Dude.
The Thunder have their first round pick, just letting you know, everybody. And the Thunder are 12-1 after winning again last night without Jalen Williams. They had a 121-92 win over the Lakers, dominant fashion. And OKC's defense, Tom, I'll tell you what, nobody has defended Luka better this entire season. The Thunder held Luka to a season low 19 points, primarily using Cason Wallace as the defender against Luka. Alex Caruso had a handful of possessions as well. And just the way in which they defended him, especially Wallace, he's smaller than Luka, but he's so sturdy as a defender. His reaction time is literally like a mirror with the way he moves and stays in front of Luka. And OKC's defense through like I said, they are 12-1 through 13 games. They have a 103 defensive rating. The Nuggets are number two in defensive rating at 109.4. That's a huge gap. And of course, we're early in the year here, but that would be by far the biggest differential between number one and number two in defensive rating in NBA history. In 07-08, wow, the Celtics had a 2.4 points per 100 possession differential over second place. In 15-16, the Spurs, 2.6. In 1920, Bucks 2.2. In 23-24, the Wolves had a 2.2 points per 100 possessions difference. And then last year, OKC 2.5 points over second place. So 103 defensive rating for Oklahoma City to boom, big drop, 6.4 points lower. Nuggets at 109.4. And OKC's on pace for 75 wins without Jalen Williams. It's so crazy.
And they could take two lottery picks and trade them and get another star.
Oh my God.
It's they have two lotto
fair.
Picks next year.
It's not
it's crazy.
Fair, Tom. Oh my God.
And like Jalen Williams was an all defensive team member last year.
Yes.
And they're trending to be the best defense. Last year I was ever. Like, this is the best defense I've ever seen.
And they're even better.
Even How? Better this year.
How?
It's great continuity, great coaching. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, earlier this season, I remember he was like top 10 in blocks per game, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And I was just like, what? The point guard, who is the reigning MVP, has now become a shot blocker to the level of a big man. And so he is a big guard for sure. But Cason Wallace, he's going to be all defensive this year. If he keeps doing this season, he's going to be on there. You could make a case for their entire starting five as being all defense. You really could. And that's really what we're talking about here is they just 1 through 5 plug and play. Doesn't matter who's out on the floor. Caruso could be the best player on the floor defensively. Chet Holmgren, Hartenstein, SGA. I could name 7 Thunder who could be the DPOY on any given night. That's how good they are defensively. It's just really hard to pinpoint one reason why they're so good defensively when they just are all Dobermans. They're all Dobermans on this team that are just going to rip you apart. Austin Reeves, Luka Doncic just looked like completely monsters stole their powers in that game on Wednesday night, and it was over before it even started. It's just OKC is every game, it's like there's another stud that just pops into the lineup and you're like, oh, he's the best player on the floor. AJ Mitchell, what? Most improved player of the year candidate, might be running away favorite for that award, where he's just like, yeah, I'm going to be the second best player for the Thunder this year after being a two-way guy last year.
I know. It's absolutely unbelievable. And A.J. Mitchell, I mean, I'm sure he'll move back to the bench once Jalen Williams is back. He could win the sixth man of the year, right? I mean, that could be the award that he ends up winning. And if it's not A.J. Mitchell, Isaiah Joe has 21 points last night. They're playing Brandon Carlson, you know, for backup center minutes, giving him an opportunity. He's looking pretty good out there defensively, protecting the rim, grabbing boards in 17 minutes. OKC is just, they're good 1 to 15. Brooks Barnheiser as a rookie looks good. It's just, it is truly a remarkable team, what they have. And I thought the Draymond Green quote from the weekend where he was talking about the Thunder and he's like, they love each other, they're connected. It reminds me of us, you know, back in the day. And it's 100% the truth with what OKC is doing. We saw Golden State once make a run at the Bulls 73 win season, of course, the 72 win season. Golden State wins 73 that year and they exceed that. They lose in the finals. OKC on pace for 75 wins at this point, Tom. I tweeted out last night. I was like, OKC really might win 70. And it's like, yes, by 70, I meant 70 plus. I should have put a plus on there. But the amount of replies are like, no. They're not going to push for 70. They're going to push for 80. That's too much, obviously. Yeah. But it's definitely, they have a shot of winning 74 games this season. It is not an exaggeration to say that. It is not at all with the way this team has looked. No championship hangover at all. That's because they don't drink, Tom. That's why there's no hangover, right?
There's no hangover because they don't drink. I like that. I think, you know, when they get J-Dub back, I just...
Oh, man.
It's over. Like, it's over. The Blazers beat them, right? And I was stunned that the Blazers were able to top that team because of how good they are, you know, top to bottom. Just they're incredibly good on both ends of the floor. And with SGA being a guy who's a two-way star, like he leads by example that he gives a lot defensively. And oh, by the way, he's going to have 30, 35 points like a metronome. You know, guaranteed that he's going to get his 30 a night. And oh, by the way, on the other end of the floor, he'll be the head of the snake. And sometimes Alex Caruso's not even going to play. And they're going to be just because of Kaysen Wallace and because of the other guys on the team, they're just, it feels like defensively, they have six guys on the floor at all times. You know? Like, you watch them play, and it's like, how do they have only five guys on the floor? They're everywhere. And right now, as of now, I'm on tankathon.com. They would have the number 7 pick and the number 9 pick from Utah in this draft, Kev. Like, they could package those, you know, and move
that
up
Utah pick is top 8 protected. Top 8 protected, true. Which... Well, you know, if Utah, they're competitive. They're having some good years from guys. They could end up with the 9th or 10th best odds. That's realistic.
Realistic.
Very well. Yeah, it's realistic, I'd say. I mean, some of those teams at the bottom aren't going anywhere. I don't think Utah is going to be bad enough to catch Washington, Indiana, Brooklyn. I wouldn't say that for sure.
And if the Kings and Dallas and Memphis pull the plug on the season, then the Western Conference gets a little bit more interesting for guys like the Utah Jazz and the Pelicans, where it's like the Pelicans are going to try to go for it because they don't have the rights to their pick this season.
Yes.
And the Pelicans are going to have every incentive not to tank and try to win as many games as possible. It's tough when you don't have Zion and DeJounte Murray and Jordan Poole out there. But as someone who just watched Derek Queen last night against the Blazers, like, they have something there, and the Pelicans are going to want to win, and I wouldn't be surprised if they try to swing a deal to try to get better this season, which makes teams like Utah and OKC's pick a lot more valuable for OKC if there is going to be some teams trying to win and some, you know, the teams that we didn't think were going to be tanking might end up actually tanking.
Yeah, kind of nuts. It is just absolutely nuts, the position that the Oklahoma City Thunder are in. It blows my mind. On the Lakers side of things, they lose that game, probably their worst loss of the season. LeBron James was assigned to the South Bay Lakers, so he is moving much, much closer to a return for LA this season. Obviously, good news for them to get a player of LeBron's caliber back on the floor. But I do think, regardless of his return, we did see the vast difference between OKC and the Lakers and really everybody else. I mean, it's just nuts. Like the Thunder, Tom, the Nuggets would be the clear favorite if Oklahoma City didn't exist. They would be the clear favorite. I noticed on Tom the Finder, you did your five-star rankings this week. You had the Thunder and the Nuggets. That's because there's no six-star for the Thunder. Not to give you an idea. Like, you could just put OKC as six. They get an extra star above everybody else. It's just true. Like, it's a big difference for the Lakers even getting LeBron back.
I was just going to ask you, dude, like, do I downgrade the Nuggets just because OKC is that good that I just put OKC on a tier on themselves? And then the question is Houston, like, what would you need to see from Houston for them to get into that tier? Because our boy Reed Shepherd, I don't know if we want to talk about it, but he's hitting up 50% from downtown this season, and he is just on fire. And he had another 20-point outing in this one off the bench, quietly rounding back into form. And this OKC offense, let's just say defensively, offensively, we have no concerns. Houston's offense has been outrageous. And so, like, it's been OKC and everybody else, but I've got my eye on Houston, the way that they're shooting the ball and defending. This Houston team is really good too. So I'm tempted right now. If I'm going to do the title tiers right now, OKC 5-star, Denver and Houston as the 4-star on a tier of themselves, and then it's everybody else. Houston and Denver are really good, but OKC is just, they're 75 win pace. What are you going to say?
I think that is spot on. I think that's the way it's going to be. OKC 5-star, Houston, Denver 4-star, and everybody else 3-2-1. Everybody else in that category. Lakers included, Warriors, Spurs included. We'll talk about them right now. Steph Curry had an awesome performance last night in a big Warriors win, a statement win over the Spurs. Steph had 46, but I felt like, Tom, this win was in large part about the defense Golden State played against Victor Wembanyama, particularly Draymond Green. Wemby was 2-for-10 in the game with multiple turnovers when he was defended by Draymond Green. And it was Draymond's best defensive game of the season from the first possession of the game, holding him away from getting to his spot throughout the entire night. He was bothering Wemby, waving his long wingspan in front of him, forcing him into tough shots, forcing some sloppy turnovers from Victor. Draymond was excellent, excellent in the game. He played like he was hungry with something to prove. And then offensively, Jimmy Butler, aggressive from start to finish in the game. He had as many threes, 7 of them, against the Spurs as he had in his last 5 games combined. And so I felt like Stephen Curry had the big night that everybody's going to talk about with 46, but Draymond and Jimmy Butler, the co-stars on that team, gave Steph the support that this team needs to win more games moving forward.
Yeah, this was a tour de force defensively, Draymond Green, and still Wemby had a triple-double, a 30-point triple-double, but he could have had a 50-pointer if it weren't for Draymond Green. Like, that's how good Draymond was defensively. And, I mean, this is another little badge for Draymond Green being the best defensive player of his generation, right? Like, of the last, 10 years, has there been a better defensive player than Draymond Green? Where, you know, at his age, going against Wemby, he's able to not shut him down, but slow him down when he's giving up a foot, you know, to Wemby, like a clear foot to Wemby. And he's such a smart defender, the way he's able to be, he doesn't let you move him off his base. He's got huge arms and he's being able to contest without fouling. And Wemby was, you know, he was out of sorts for a lot of this game. And you're right. Stephen Curry, 46 points, was a supernova offensively. Draymond Green was locked in. What happened to Jonathan Kuminga? That thing went so fast from, hey, he's doing all the right things, he's starting, he's playing well, to he's back in the doghouse 12 minutes and he didn't score a single point. I think he took one shot in this game. And the agenda comments from Draymond Green, I don't think is any coincidence that that Steve Kerr made a switch to the starting lineup. You saw this defensive output, and Jonathan Kuminga was nowhere to be seen in this game.
Yeah, Kuminga got benched in this game. This season, he's, you know, made an effort to pass the ball more and to rebound more. You know, credit where it's due there. But offensively, besides really, I felt like his first game of the season against the Lakers, aside from that, he looks the same as he did last year. And I think for the Warriors, it was the right decision to bench him. And for him in the game, like, he goes out after 12 minutes with knee soreness. I wonder how much of that was a legitimate injury versus like sour grapes from being benched. But he had a worse game of the season after the move to the bench. And ultimately, the Warriors played better in part in his absence. And you mentioned those comments from Draymond Green. So Anthony Slater over at ESPN reported on Wednesday morning about those comments that, you know, some of the players on the team felt a certain kind of way about Pods, because Pods before the season was asked about his ambitions, and he's like, I want to be, you know, better than Stephen Curry. And Anthony Slater wrote an answer that elicited some eye rolls and continued references from several within the organization. And then after their last loss, both Jimmy Butler and Draymond Green had some comments as well. That's why Slater wrote about this. Draymond had, you know, said, I think everybody was committed to winning back in the day. You know, at this point, it doesn't feel that way. I think everyone has a personal agenda in this league, but you have to make those personal agendas work within the team confines. If that doesn't work, you got to get rid of your agenda. And then Jimmy Butler, you know, was asked about that. And he's like, well, everybody's got to be honest with themselves. We got to get back to doing whatever it takes to win. Everybody might have to sacrifice, and so on and so forth, right? And so my sense from those comments, from Anthony Slater's report, and from just reading the room with Warriors fans are so often pointing the finger at Pods and pointing the finger at Kuminga. So over on Threads, I made a post where I was like, who cares if Pods wants to be better than Stephen Curry? Who cares? Warriors shouldn't be side-eyeing him. Fans shouldn't be blaming him. And I said, the old guys are the problem in Golden State, not the youth. Draymond Green has declined, and Jimmy Butler has always been a malcontent who has failed to step up in the biggest moments for multiple years now. As we've talked about earlier in the podcast, last 11 elimination games has not shot the ball often enough or efficiently enough. And I said, this is on them more than anyone else. Still, Steph Curry is still great. Deserves so much better. Well, little did I expect, Draymond Green himself responded to that, Tom. He said, who said was the young guys, Kevin? I said, we. One thing for certain, I don't mince words, and you don't have to speak for me. That's what the Draymond Green show is for. I speak for me always. And then he replied again, and he said, and I'm certain I know far more than you do about winning. You couldn't win your intramural sports. I thought it was a good idea to become a, quote, NBA writer. And if you want to do some in-depth analysis and game breakdown, I will also put you to shame at that. Look, of course, you're a Hall of Famer. Of course, you're going to be better at that than me, Draymond. And I responded to that. Level-headed response, I felt like. I said, when did I say anything about what you said post-game? Which is true. I don't feel like I was talking specifically about him. Not a thing.
Oh.
My Pods comment was partially about the Anthony Slater report. The players rolled their eyes at his comments slash goals. But it was also about what I'm reading from the fans. Warriors fans seem to be mostly pointing fingers at the young guys. I don't think that's fair at all. Butler took three shots last night. This was Monday night. And Tuesday night. We know he's capable of much more. And you yourself said this week you've failed the defense so far this year, which is true. Draymond himself said, I've failed our defense when it looks as crappy as it does. I've failed. You can send as many messages as you want as till we do it. I'm failing at that. And so, you know, I felt like, yeah, of course, Draymond and Butler could step up like they did, by the way, on Wednesday night, Tom. And then this is the good one.
What?
Draymond responded again. He said, you have all the answers, genius, and you want more views. Here's your help. Would you like to do a film breakdown? Maybe your basketball knowledge has grown over the last 4 years. The number one pick. Wow, you stink at this. And attached was a link to my appearance in 2020 on the Ryan Russillo podcast talking about the case for Killian Hayes as the number one pick. It's like, great, Draymond.
That's off.
Great stuff.
I got to hand it to him.
It was great. It was really
that
good.
Was great.
Well done, Draymond.
That was great.
I did respond to that. He has not responded from what I've seen since. And I just said, just the opposite, Draymond. I don't have all the answers, and I'll be wrong plenty of times. Just like Bob Myers was in that same 2020 draft taking Wiseman. And I'll be right plenty of times, too, just like he was selecting you years ago. And this is what I really feel here, Tom. I said, your reaction is so strange. You're going back 5 years for this for what? You said this week you failed the defense and Butler needs to be better than taking three shots, clearly. It's more reasonable to expect more from you two veterans than from the youth. And I think that's exactly what happened on Wednesday night, Tom. Butler and Draymond were awesome. They were incredible. Kuminga didn't play the whole second half. Pods was typical Pods, but it was Draymond and Jimmy Butler raising their abilities to the level that we all know that they can reach. And what happened? The Warriors had a big win against the Spurs with Draymond defending Wemby better than anybody has this entire season. Jimmy Butler having his best offensive game overall. And Stephen Curry, 46 points, got the support he needed, not from the kids, from the vets, the guys that have been heavily invested in. So I think Draymond knows it. He just likes to talk. And I like to talk, too. It's fun to talk trash. To just hey. But I loved it.
Kev, I'm going to say it for you. Warriors fans, you're welcome. You're welcome. Without Kev, they don't get that fiery performance from Draymond. Without Kev, you're not getting that amazing 46 supernova from Stephen Curry. Everyone was fired up because they wanted to prove you wrong, Kev, but prove you right by saying, hey, the veterans, as they've come up short before and how good they've done, you know, winning those championships, like this whole Pods and Kuminga, the weird wedge in that locker room that appears because you have Draymond Green saying those things. You're quoting Draymond Green this season. I think you're absolutely right. And I also think the reason why Draymond Green was so fired up and provoked in this is because you struck a chord. You struck a chord with him. And sometimes when it hits bone, it hurts a lot more, right? So I think Draymond, it's great that he's engaged on this and he's interacting with you on this. And I think the Killian Hayes shout out was fantastic. And that's a good. That's good. Barbs, it's good back and forth. I love this.
I loved it.
And you know what? Take ownership of it. Tell the Warriors fans you're welcome. And I turned around the season for you because you know what? You did, Kev. You did. It's all because of you. So,
I'm going to 2 years in a row, Tom. Last year, it wasn't the Butler trade. It was me saying, don't trade for Butler. Trade Steph and Draymond. 2 years in a row, I helped you guys out. Congrats.
Hashtag Kev's
as if you guys
better.
Haven't won enough.
Yeah. Man, I had no idea. You know, I had no idea that you were sitting on that exchange. Like we went, how many minutes in this pod? And you were just, you had that in your back pocket. Yeah. So you went, this was when Tuesday when you guys had this the back
was,
and forth?
This was yesterday, Wednesday. So this was on Wednesday.
Wow.
Yeah. I had my phone on Do Not Disturb and I got a text. A screenshot of Draymond's two responses to me in one of my group chats. And I was like, oh my God.
Here we go.
All right. I got to respond now. I felt like I was very level-headed in my responses, which I typically am. Draymond, the Killian Hayes thing was very, very funny. That was great. Some responses to that saying, is this about Ryan or KOC? It's like, no, it's about me.
I don't want it to be about me, but I'm going to say it's about me. Ryan has nothing to do with this.
I will definitely own that. That's for sure. I mean, biggest mistake of my career covering the draft. I hope.
But you don't take yourself too seriously, and that's important here, is that we have to have a thick skin when you're working in media. And Draymond Green coming at you about, you know, the Killian Hayes pick, that's good. That's good. And you're able to laugh at it, which is so hard. I think a lot of media folks, I don't think, would be able to laugh about something like that because they would take themselves too seriously and get even more dug in and entrenched in your opinion. And instead, we're sitting here. I think that's a wonderful exchange. I think that's great. And you know what? I think Steve Kerr would be very happy with you, the whole Warriors organization. I've had that happen to me before. When I was reporting for the Miami Heat, it was like there were ways that I could get underneath LeBron's skin and kind of alert him to stats or whether he was loafing or whether he was coasting. And it was oftentimes, it was like the media is the only people that they'll listen to sometimes. When the media is writing about some of their weaknesses or their insecurities or their weak points in their game, then they will turn on and reverse course and actually listen to that. If it's a coach, if it's a teammate, if it's someone in their circle, they might not be willing to hear that. But when it's Kevin O'Connor saying that, sometimes it does provoke action in ways that they might not do that for someone within the Warriors organization. So I do think there is power in the media. I mean, we see it with Dwight Howard and his free throws and try not to be on Shaqt in a fool. The media does have an influence. And hell, the Nico Harrison chants, like the Jason Kidd in his comments after the Nico Harrison news came out, he was very much saying it was disrespectful of the fans to be saying fire Nico during PJ Washington's late game free throws. That was disrespectful. But part of me said, you know what? It feels good that the people matter, that the voices can be heard on these things, and that the media matters, and the money that the players are getting, a lot of it is because of the TV rights and the media deals that the NBA is signing. And so I think part of me is like, you know, it's good that Draymond Green is clapping back and engaging with the media, because I think it shows that the media matters, the fans matter, and I think we need that to matter in order for all of this to feel like the stakes are high. Every game, the stakes are high. And when people go to the games, that their voices can matter and have... We want Mavs fans to feel part of the team, that their voice does matter. And I think in a weird way, I'm thinking about the Nico Harrison stuff with the Draymond comments, that we do matter. The media matters and the fan bases matter. And that's great for the ecosystem of the NBA.
I mean, ultimately, I do think that's spot on, Tom. I mean, I do think the voices matter. The fan voices should matter. None of us have a job if the fans didn't exist. As podcasters, as players, as coaches, as the commissioner, nobody's has a job. And if there weren't as many fans, you wouldn't be making any money, or you'd be working summer jobs like Tommy Heinsohn and the 60 Celtics guys had to do. I mean, like, it's just part of it, right? And so the fans ultimately are the number one responsibility, in my opinion, as a serving podcaster. Like, yep. I always serve the fans, and I think that's true also for the NBA itself as well. And we'll be right back after this break. In regards to Nico Harrison, undoubtedly, the Dallas Mavericks fans, their voice did make an impact here, on top of course, the Mavericks getting off to a horrific start to the season. Never mind the big mistake 9 months ago, the worst trade since Babe Ruth was traded from the Red Sox to the Yankees, trading Luka to the Lakers. Nico Harrison was overdue. He should have been fired as soon as he approached Patrick Dumont with the idea to make this trade. He should have been fired then. And ultimately, Dumont made a mistake. Usually, Tom, like, how often do new owners like Matt Ishbia with the Phoenix Suns, they meddle too much, right? They meddle too much as soon as they get an opportunity. Dumont didn't meddle enough. He was sat on his hands. He just trusted this GM he inherited. Idiotic decision by him. Very poor decision making to empower Nico to make that move. And ultimately, I mean, as Jason Gallagher, that post on screen, had said, I mean, there's an ignorance to Nico Harrison, both from the fans, and there's been multiple reports about with executives underneath him, with those who didn't align with his vision for the team. And so Dallas is not a championship contender as he expected them to be. They are not an elite defense as he expected them to be. They are a subpar team that currently is going through a lot of injuries. No surprise, considering Kyrie, AD, and so on, the history of those guys on the team. So ultimately, Tom, I think for Dallas fans, good for you that, like, you're able to start moving forward here. But Tom, I don't think Nico being fired can be the end of things here. To me, this needs to be the beginning of a lot of changes here. I think the Mavericks need to now move forward with looking for Anthony Davis trades, Kyrie Irving trades, listening to what you can get for some of those younger veterans. Like, is someone going to go over the top for Daniel Gafford or PJ Washington? And at this point, for the Mavericks, they have their 2026 first-round pick, Tom, and then they don't have the rights to their first again until 2031. This is really the last chance for Dallas with their own pick to find a young star to pair with Cooper Flagg. And considering the incredible strength of this draft class that seems to be only getting better as the weeks go by in college basketball, Dallas needs to blow it up, in my opinion. Nico can't be the end here, Tom. It's got to be the beginning of really blowing up everything at this point in order to build properly around Cooper Flagg moving forward.
How did the Oklahoma City Thunder get to where they are right now? It's because they looked in the mirror and they said, yeah, we're going to move off of Russell Westbrook and the Paul George and start from scratch, break it down to the studs. And it's time for Dallas to do the same thing, is to understand that their picks, the supporting cast, everything needs to revolve around how to build around Cooper Flagg. This is Cooper Flagg's team. Who's going to be the GM? Who's going to be the head coach? Who's going to be his co-stars? And it behooves them to break this all down and build from the ground up around Cooper Flagg. First, second, and third thing needs to happen is to build around that dude. No more about Kyrie Irving. No more about AD and PJ Washington and the big guys in the middle. It's all about Cooper Flagg. And, you know, I wrote about this for Yahoo Sports. The idea of like who is going to replace Nico Harrison, a lot of people you're seeing, I think Zach Lowe mentioned it, Chris Mannix mentioned it, is like maybe Jason Kidd moves upstairs into the GM room in the front office. I think if you're Patrick Dumont, you have to just clean house. You have to just, everybody who was involved on the Luka Doncic trade, and of course, Dumont himself, unless he removes himself as the owner of the team, which isn't going to happen, I think he has to do right by the fans and just start from scratch to build the credibility back with the fans. And Jason Kidd was sitting next to Nico Harrison during the first press conference after the trade. And Nico said, I did this trade and this guy right here supported it, but I did the trade. And I can only imagine now Jason Kidd would like to distance himself from that Luka Doncic trade. Maybe then he wanted to distance himself, but he was sitting next to Nico in that press conference afterwards. And so I just feel like in order for the Dallas Mavericks to do right by its fans and do right by Cooper Flagg, let's make no mistake about it. He said it after the game. I don't care about everything that's happening on above me. That's above me. I just focus on basketball and I focus on what we're doing in the locker room. But I think it would be prudent for this organization to do everything they can to remove themselves from the Luka Doncic trade. Just totally exercise yourself from that awful trade. And that means cleaning house top to bottom.
I 100% agree. It's like throwing out your ex's clothes or whatever, you know, a gift they might have given you. Just to get it. Sometimes you're just gonna move on. That's how you're gonna do it.
like I don't know. I wrote five candidates to replace Nico. I put in Bob Myers because of the connections with Rick Welts, who's the CEO and on the business side of the Mavericks. Mentioned him. I mentioned having a nostalgic play with Dirk Nowitzki and Steve Nash, whether Steve Nash is the coach or in the front office. But
you're trying to ruin the Amazon broadcast, Tom? That's great.
I know. Look,
come on, Tom.
Isn't it kind of weird how Mind the Game is now like the pipeline to the NBA's top jobs? Like JJ Redick left to go take the Lakers job and left ESPN and the pod to go coach LeBron James and Luka Doncic. And then now I'm like Steve Nash also Mind the Game and Amazon Prime. I'm sorry. I had to apologize to Amazon Prime in that column. I was like, look, I know this is going to hurt, but it would be really cool if Dirk and Nash went back to the Mavs and they just made right by the fans. I think Rich Paul also very interesting because of the Anthony Davis connection. And he's also the rep for Derek Lively. I got to imagine, I have no intel on this, but I got to imagine Rich Paul and the way things went down with the Luka trade. I don't think that he's nearly as close to running the show in the Lakerland like people believed he was before that trade. And if you're Rich Paul and you have the opportunity to build around Cooper Flagg and have a GM job or running basketball ops, I don't know. That's an opportunity that I think there's more there than people are willing to admit. I think Rich Paul does have aspirations at some point to run an NBA team. I just, from where I sit, because look, Bob Myers did it. Arne Tellem did it. Leon Rose did it. moving from agent, super agent to the, a GM job. And I wouldn't be surprised if Rich Paul does it one day. And Grant Hill is another name I threw on there, is a Dallas native, born in Dallas. His dad played for the Cowboys, and now he's in the front office, the ownership group with the Atlanta Hawks, of course, and he would have to separate himself from the Atlanta Hawks. But I think of those candidates there, I think just to win back the fans, Dirk and Nash makes the most sense. But I also think either one of those, it would be good to move away from the Jason Kidd, Nico Harrison era and bring in a new regime.
Yeah, I think at some point, just to address the Rich Paul aspect, I do think at some point he'd love to take that leap. When? Who knows? We'll see. But ultimately, I think for the Dallas Mavericks, Tom, Anthony Davis, trading him is priority number one. Over at Yahoo, I wrote a column about, you know, just explaining to Mavericks fans the pressure to build now around Cooper with the how strong this draft class is, like beyond AJ DiBanza, Darren Peterson, Cam Booz, or just some of the other guys in this class. Caleb Wilson from North Carolina says he'll be number one. He says he wants to prove to people he'll be number one. Somebody in his camp said to me, he is number one. We'll see in time, but he looks awesome. And so I think ultimately, like, you're going to see multiple guys that push for the top three. That's how strong this class is feeling. Nate Ament from Tennessee, Mikael Brown from Louisville had a big game earlier this week as well. Talked about him with James Barlow on the podcast. The point is that normally, Tom, like in a draft, think about last year with Cooper, right? Cooper, number one pick. Dallas has the 11th best odds. It feels like a miracle. You get number one. All those other teams that had the top odds that moved down to four or five or six, they were bummed. This year, I think because the draft is so strong, aside from the top two or top three, this is the best year to be disappointed. If you're the Wizards and you end up with number four instead of number one, it's like, that sucks. But we still get a great player, a player who in most years would be worthy of the second or third or even first pick. And so I think for Dallas this year, right now, they are 3-9, tied for the fifth worst record. That comes with a 9.8% chance of moving up to number one, a 39.9% chance of being in the top four. If they stayed at five, that's not so bad. Point being is for Dallas, there's a chance here to get a player to grow with Cooper. But AD will be back eventually. Kyrie could come back. Klay could remember how to play basketball. They need to trade some of these guys in order to assure they maximize not only their odds for number one, but their positioning in the draft lottery, where if you lose, you still have an opportunity to take a great player. And so I think I have two fake trade ideas for you, Tom. One involving the Pistons for Anthony Davis, because with the Pistons, as we talked about a week ago, with Jalen Duren and Isaiah Stewart, how great two bigs have been for the Pistons. Why not double down on that? Go get AD for Jaden Ivey, Caris LeVert, Tobias Harris, and two future first-round picks. They have all of their future picks, so they could plug it into the years that Dallas wants to optimize their flexibility moving forward. To me, this feels like a low price to play for a player of 80s caliber. If you're the Pistons, to try to increase your odds already, as currently, as of Wednesday, the number one team in the Eastern Conference at 10-2. Why not double down and further increase your odds?
Wow. Wow, that would be a huge trade. I would hope that Anthony Davis would be able to play more than he has in Dallas for that to be a home run swing that could go over the fence. Look, Jalen Duren is so good, and you put him next to Anthony Davis, that defense, I was thinking you were going to trade Beef Stew or Duren in that trade, but now I'm looking at this one, and you're not really giving up any. I mean, Jaden Ivey hasn't been part of this ascension from the Detroit Pistons, so you could talk yourself into, like, let him develop somewhere else if we can get a guy like Anthony Davis. What's interesting there is that Dennis Lindsay is the number two in Detroit right now. And, of course, he was part of the NBA Finals team. The front office for the NBA Finals team as an advisor or as a consultant for the Dallas Mavericks, not necessarily running the show next to Nico Harrison, but would he want to sign off along with Trajan Langdon on bringing Anthony Davis to this squad? If you're not giving up your young core in Cade Cunningham, Jalen Duren, or Isaiah Stewart, I mean, that's a deal worth looking at for sure.
And the other one I want to get your feelings on here, Tom, is involving the Atlanta Hawks. So with the Hawks, let's send AD to the Atlanta Hawks for Asa Newell, Kristaps Porzingis, Luke Kennard, and two future first. KP, very good player. I do worry about that POTS thing that can come and go for him. And ultimately, I do think AD, regardless of KP being on the floor or not, is an upgrade over KP. Asa Newell could be a nice young player for Dallas to get back. To me, this one feels like it could be slightly too much for Atlanta to invest in, but I'm also intrigued with them. Again, the East feels open. The team has not been quite up to expectations so far. So far this year, Atlanta is only 7-5. Solid, but I think there are higher expectations for them. What do you think about this deal for Atlanta?
What about Trae Young? Because Trae Young, he can be a free agent this offseason, right? He's got a player option for next year. They have done fairly well without him this season, like you said. They've had questions very about the future of Trae Young. And then you move Trae Young, and Dallas can decide whether we want to have Trae Young here right by Oklahoma where he's from, or we decide, you know what, he's not the right fit for us, but you get off of the Anthony Davis money long term. And that's something we talked about on The Big Number, is that like Anthony Davis and Kyrie Irving never played together or finished a game together. There's a lot of injury risk there, but also you need to find a team in the Eastern Conference where they have their own disgruntled star to get to that Anthony Davis number, the cap number. Because a lot of these teams, like you have in the proposal, they have to put like 3-4 guys into the trade to get to Anthony Davis's cap number. And I wonder if you're the Atlanta Hawks, do you just move Trae Young instead? And that way you don't have to deal with, you know, whether he is the future there in Atlanta anymore. And then on the other side is they need a ball handler for Dallas. They do. Not to say that they're going to try to contend, but I do think you need a point guard, and Trae Young could be that guy. I don't love that deal or the Trae Young formation, but I do think that like Atlanta and Detroit are absolutely the teams that should be calling about Anthony Davis for this reason.
Yeah,
the East is there for the taking. It's there for the taking.
You got to go for it, Tom. I mean, I think some of these teams that there's not when you talk to people around the league, the sense is that this could be a dry market. Like there's just not like Domantas Sabonis could be available, right? If the Grizzlies decide to pull the plug, whatever's left with Ja Morant, right? Like it's so far, it's not clear-cut stars. And granted, Anthony Davis comes with his own risks as well, considering his lack of durability and the current injury that he has with that Achilles tendonitis. Scary for a guy like him on the wrong side of 30, but ultimately I think the East is open for those two teams and makes all the sense in the world to at least explore AD trades. That's the Hawks and the Pistons. I think if the Grizzlies wanted to double down, you know, maybe you trade KCP, Aldama, Brandon Clark, maybe go get AD, then you get AD and JJJ and Ja Morant. Maybe you can talk yourself into it. The Heat, I could see you talking into it with a Bam, AD front court, give up Hero and Rozier and a pick or so. I think there's something there maybe. I could see the Timberwolves. You know, we talked last week, Tom, about how bad they've been off defensively when Gobert is off the floor. They have a 105.7 defensive rating with Gobert, 130.2 without him. AD, Gobert, you know, AD would be an upgrade over Julius Randle. I think those are really the only teams that I could make an argument for, but ultimately there's not a lot out there for him. There's definitely even less teams out there for Kyrie Irving. But if Dallas did put those guys on the table, there'd be at least some bites at the apple for them. And I think the same is also true for the Sacramento Kings. Over at Sacktown Sports 1140 earlier this week, one of their hosts, Carmichael Dave, reported that the Kings are gearing up for a potential rebuild. Guys like Zach LaVine, Domantas Sabonis, DeMar DeRozan could all be on the trading block. And I think this aligns with what we've been talking about here with the state of this NBA draft. The Kings are 3-9 this year so far with some of these guys missing time. But this is an opportunity to get a stud. And to me, this is the clear, correct path moving forward for the Kings. This team is going nowhere, Tom. They're going nowhere. They're not good. This fit doesn't work. They should be looking to trade these guys, especially in what could be a drier trade market. Some team could feel like LaVine or Sabonis or whoever it might be could be the final piece of their puzzle.
Yeah, it's time to blow it up there, and it's been time for quite a while. And Doug Christie had some comments after in recent days about, you know, having some pride in Sacktown and the culture of the team and all this. And I'm like, what are we talking about here? The Kings, outside of the light the beam season, like, what is the Sacramento Kings culture, right? They've been to
those
the playoffs
Those were weird comments
once.
By Christie, Tom, that you mentioned. Those are very strange. I was like, what?
Super strange. The statement to going after the media and the haters out there.
What?
Look, since 2006, the Kings have made the playoffs once in 20 years. That's it. Like, that's it. That's all that needs to be said. It's not the media's fault here. It's not the haters' fault. You're 3-9 right now. You haven't made the playoffs in 20 out of the last 21 seasons. So in terms of like unrest or haters out there, and you know who you are in the media, like, man, just focus on the team, and you didn't have to make enemies of the media or the fans. If the fans are unhappy, it's because they've had one playoff team in the last 20 years. And it's just, it's frustrating to see that the fans or the media are at fault, and he's taking it personally and calling out the media and just being like, you know who you are. When, like, let's just call it what it is. It's been a sorry franchise for a very long time, and the fans and the media have every right to call them out, and that's what the media does. It's accountability. It's all it is accountability. And they're 3-9, and they got the doors blown off of them by an Atlanta Hawks team that were missing a couple guys. So it's just, I found those comments to be really weird, and I think it's really difficult to blow up this team when you're kind of selling low on a lot of these guys. Like, a lot of the guys they're trying to get rid of, it's just that, what are you going to get back for them?
Not a lot, but hopefully something, you know, maybe a pick, something of value, something. But what you're really getting is you're increasing the value of your own pick. And I hope for Sacramento that's what ends up happening here. Let's talk about some rookies here, Tom. Con Knipple. Having one hell of a year for the Charlotte Hornets. Knipple this season, Tom, 16.6 points per game, 6.4 rebounds, 39.8% from three on 8 attempts per game, also tacking on 2.8 assists. Con this year, I loved him in the draft. I knew he would shoot the hell out of it from three-point range. I knew that was a given. The way he can move off ball, the ability to stop on a dime, but the off the dribble stuff that he's incorporating into his game. I talked to him, interviewed him earlier in the year. He said that was the number one thing he was working on, was his ability to hit jumpers off the dribble, his ability to get to the basket. And that's what we're seeing so far with the Charlotte Hornets early on this season. I've just been beyond impressed by everything besides the shooting from Con. And that was the biggest question with him. He's finishing better off of both 1 foot and 2 feet at the rim. He's finishing against length and versatility and size, finishing through contact, using different angles at the rim. They're using him as a screener sometimes, and he's hitting buckets out of the short roll and making the right pass. And like, he's just being put into so many different actions. And to me, so far this season, Tom, Knipple is the rookie of the year. He's exceeded VJ Edgecombe. Edgecombe slipping as of late. This last five games, he's shooting only 28% from the field. Still 15 points a game, 5 boards, 4 assists, still good raw numbers, but his efficiency has dropped. Cowered before Wednesday night's game against the Celtics when he went 3-for-12. Was 50-40-90 on the year. That's crazy as a rookie. To me, I think Cooper Flagg is probably fourth right now. Again, early on. I am worried with Cooper, though. He went out temporarily in a Wednesday night's game with a shoulder issue. That could be something that's really bothering him. And there's no clear guy for fifth.
Dude, that block. Be hard. Yo, that block.
The block was awesome.
Yo.
And Cooper, by the way, has a chance to end up number one at the end of the year, like everybody predicted. But to me, it's Con Knipple so far this season as the rookie of the year, about, you know, a little less than a month in so far. He's been outstanding, Tom.
I mean, did anyone win more on draft night than the Charlotte Hornets with him and Kalkbrenner?
Oh my God.
Like, that dude can play too. And these rookies should not be able to be as good as they are this soon. They shouldn't be. And yet they are. And that's great coaching. That's great drafting. And the Charlotte Hornets have gotten next to nothing out of LaMelo Ball and Brandon Miller. And still, they haven't missed a step. I think the Charlotte Hornets fans have to be thrilled with how they've handled the draft in the last couple of years. And when you're looking at a guy like Con Knipple, dude's solid. He's really solid, and his improvement from last year, like you said, off the dribble, and he's not just a shooter. He's not just a solid guy, a low mistake guy. He's got a lot higher ceiling than I think a lot of people gave him credit for on draft night.
Oh, no doubt about it, and that's because of the off the dribble development. He's been excellent, and I look forward to seeing how his year continues. There are some awful teams in the NBA, Tom, so far this season. The Wizards are 1-11. The Pacers and Nets are both 1-10. The Pelicans are 2-9. You saw the Pelicans last night. And Derek Queen, he is a silver lining on an awful team. Derek Queen looked sensational, Tom. Tell me about what you saw from Queen.
Amazing touch. Incredible touch around the basket. You know, the Blazers have a 7'3" Donovan Clingan guarding him, and he puts his shoulder into you. He's got great touch. And Clingan is top five in defensive field goal percentage last year and this year. He's one of the best rim protectors in the league. And yet what Derek Queen was doing against Rob Williams and Donovan Clingan was special. He's got great sense of spacing, touch around the basket, strength. He's a big body. And I think there's a lot of Boogie Cousins in his game in the sense that he's a huge body, but he has guard skills. Like Boogie Cousins had great passing ability. And even though he didn't have a great vertical, he used his body. I kept seeing Boogie and Z-Bo. Like when I was watching Derek Queen in that game on Wednesday night, it's just he's so gifted and crafty around the basket, and he's got some flair to his game. He runs well. I think, you know, Derek Queen, if he can be sized next to another like rim protector, a guy who can kind of play above the basket defensively a little bit more, they've got a really special team. With Fears looked awesome too. I gotta say, I've been harsh on Joe Dumars because of that trade with the Indiana Pacers and then flipping that pick to move up to go get Derek Queen and sending that next year's pick to Atlanta. But the way that Fears and Derek Queen have looked, they're a great future there in New Orleans. Those two guys were awesome last night. And I will say, Derek Queen, he looked every bit the star that he has to be to justify that trade. He looked great.
Yeah, and I hope it works out for the Pelicans. I do. I mean, I know sometimes like we joke about them and all that, but I feel for those fans. We're talking about Kings fans and how they've never made the playoffs except for one time, one memorable great season. The Pelicans have had some really rough times as well in New Orleans. I think for some of these other true one-win teams, like the Nets, like you get to really squint, but it's like Yegor Demin, you know, he's shooting pretty well. He's, you know, 18 of 48 from three, 37.5%. It's nice to see him shooting the ball well. 5 for 6 from the free throw line. Shot below 70%. He's playing pretty well. The Pacers, I mean, my Jairus Walker stock is deep in the red, Tom. It is not looking good. I really can't find any silver linings with the Pacers so far this year. If you're a Pacers fan, please comment with a silver lining. I can't find one other than the light at the end of the tunnel with a high draft pick at the end of the season. But guys are out. You know, I think Nembhard hasn't elevated his play in the way you'd hope. Benedict Mathurin is out right now. But the clear silver lining of the one-win teams, Tom, is Alex Saar. Alex Saar for the Washington Wizards. He is talking about a guy taking a leap in the second year. Saar so far this year averaging 19.1 points per game, 8.6 boards, 3.8 assists per game. And against the Houston Rockets on Wednesday night, a really great defense, 25 points, 11 boards, 4 assists, scoring in so many different ways as a screener, hitting threes, finishing lob dunk opportunities, hitting little in-between shots, push shots from the free throw line. And this is what Saar has done all year long. This isn't just a one blip so far for the Wizards so far. He looks more comfortable attacking closeouts. His handle looks tighter. He looks stronger so far this season at finishing through contact. And overall, like some of the flashes we've seen from him with some turnaround jumpers that he's hit after driving to the basket from the mid-range, those are the moments where you're like, well, wait a minute. Is he just going to be a really good role player, or is there some star upside here? And I think for Wizards fans, your team stinks. You're hoping for a high lottery pick, but the youth are getting better. And that's what it's about. That's what winning is this year, is seeing Keyshawn George and Trey Johnson and hopefully Alex Saar continuing to ascend over the course of the season, because I've been very impressed by Saar, Tom. It makes me happy to see him doing well, even though the Wizards are losing games.
I always wonder what would Chris Bosh look like in today's NBA, in the modern NBA, spacing and stretch fives. And Alex Sarr is him. Like Alex Sarr, he is an offensive minded guy who has great, you know, touch and great shooting ability and ability to put it on the deck. He's not, you know, as strong as a rim protector as you might like to have a two way guy, but he's blocking shots right now. And I just think he's smooth, man. And Chris Bosh, if you put him in today's NBA, he's every bit the star that he was, but I think he's even better because of the spacing and the appreciation of the guardification of bigs. I feel like Bosh would be so much better in this era. And I feel like Sarr is kind of Bosh 2.0, and he's playing like it right now.
That's a good comp, Tom. I appreciate you so much for joining me today, man. Thank you, Tom. Hope you have a good rest of your week, man.
Yeah, dude. Appreciate it. And yeah, this is the Thunder, man. The Thunder.
Woo! 12-1 without Jalen Williams. What?
I know. It's crazy. Thank you, Tom. I appreciate you having me on. I can't wait for next week, dude.
You check out Tom on The Big Number every Wednesday. Him and Dan Devine diving into the NBA. Thank you, Tom. All right, let's talk a little bit of NFL. My Patriots play on Thursday night. Big game against the Jets. Hopefully they keep on rolling. And to talk about the NFL, here's Field Yates. All right, now time for another edition of 6 Points. Joining me from ESPN, it's Field Yates. Field, what's up?
KOC, not too much, my friend. We are cruising through football season. Have no idea where it's all gone, but what a fun time of the year we have on tap.
I mean, all the days go by so fast. It's really absolutely crazy. Already week 10 has passed. The Patriots are 8-2. So we're going to start there with my New England Patriots. 8-2, tied for the best record in the AFC. It's hard to believe they're at this point after a bad week one loss. They looked more like the Patriots of last year. Winners of 7 in a row at this point. Fields, am I in the right to be feeling like the Patriots are actually Super Bowl contenders?
I think they're in the mix, yeah. I think that right now, I mean, we're far enough into the season where independent of who you played, where you played them, if you're 8-2, like that's pretty much inarguable. And the way the Patriots' schedule shapes up for the rest of the year and the division lead they now have gives them a real chance to potentially have a top two seed, maybe even the number one seed in the AFC. You know, defensively, they seem to start slow every single game and then settle in really nicely. And they have done a good job against some of the best quarterbacks they have faced all season, both Baker Mayfield most recently, and then Josh Allen in a huge game in Buffalo they played against, where they did a good job of not allowing those guys to just take control of the game. But I think the two things that I point to that are most important, at least in terms of player personnel right now for the Patriots, obviously Drake May, who over at ESPN Bet is the betting favorite as the NFL MVP right now. His development this year has been sensational. It's unbelievable, almost literally, that he is just 23 years old. But not to be overlooked is that the Patriots have continuity along the offensive line. And continuity along the offensive line only comes when two things are true. One, obviously, you don't have injuries, or at least that many injuries. But two, you have reliable players. And last year, as you, I'm sure, recall, KOC, the offensive line, it was basically a carousel. Every week, you just spin it, and next thing you know, a new set of five offensive linemen would be rolled out. The Patriots are in a much different and much healthier spot this year along the offensive line. I think that has really unlocked a lot of their offensive success beyond Drake May's freakish abilities.
I mean, you mentioned the continuity on the offensive line, and that's the thing. Like, so much talk is around Drake May and his development as an MVP candidate and all that, but continuity on the offensive line, you're getting the explosive Drake May deep throws, big plays from Travion Henderson, Williams, of course, Stevenson before he went out injured. He had big plays himself as well. There's big plays ability here for the Patriots. They hit their layups as well, and then they're just a tough team as well. They have a great run defense. They're a great running team. They have a great special teams, and so when I see stuff on social media about their week schedule, Aaron Schatz posted a tweet the other day about their DVOA and how it's minus 1.6% on the year. The only other team to have an 8-2 record and have a DVOA under zero was the 2022 Vikings, minus 12.1%. And so the thing is, you know, the Patriots are 10th in DVOA on offense, 29th on defense. Patriots defense is better than that, according to DVOA. I mean, tell me, Phil, DVOA is going to be full of crap, right?
Yeah, you know, I don't know as much as Aaron does, but I do think this Patriots defense is better than, you said, 29th in DVOA. I can certainly think of, you know, way more than three defenses that are worse than this Patriots defense. You mentioned the elite run defense. They did not have their best defensive player, maybe their best player not named Drake May, in Christian Gonzalez to begin the season. They've done a good job. Again, they slow start seemingly every single week. It happened this past week against the Buccaneers. Once again, they drive down for an opening score, and next thing you know, it's deja vu all over again. But then they tighten up, and this team, and we talked about all the player stuff, but you know, I think it's obvious that we have to address that we're talking about one of the greatest coaching upgrades we have seen from one year to the next in league history. I mean, Mike Vrabel is on the short list for best leaders in the NFL, one of the best leaders in all of professional sports, I truly believe. Josh McDaniels, say whatever you want about how his tenure has gone as a head coach previously. I think he is a mastermind. He is a Hall of Fame level offensive coordinator and has done wonders for not just Drake May's development, but his confidence as well. Yes, the Patriots have Stephon Diggs, who's playing better of late, but they're also getting some contributions from young players and guys that we weren't really thinking about coming into this season, right? Pop Douglas has been much more effective this year for New England than he was in his first two seasons. Kayshon Booty, who when he's healthy is their only every down wide receiver, who plays like 90%+ of the snaps, and a guy that came out of LSU, did not run some 4.35 40, but between his timing instincts and ball skills and Drake May's exceptional deep ball accuracy, has become one of the NFL's most effective deep ball receivers. So a ton of credit to the coaching staff for the Patriots. This team is fun to watch every single week, and they're not going anywhere because the quarterback is 23 years old. And while they did add a couple of veterans this offseason that are a little bit older, Morgan Moses along the offensive line, and Harold Landry, I think he's 28 now on the defensive side of the ball. There are lots of reasons to believe that this team is maybe different than a team like Washington, who's kind of been undone by injuries this year. But Washington was also an older roster in a hurry, as opposed to where New England, I think, just a younger team that has a chance to make this something that could stick for a while.
I mean, you mentioned how there's guys who we haven't been thinking about that have performed great for the Patriots. One of the guys that we thought a lot about entering the season from a fantasy standpoint was Travion Henderson. And he was an afterthought, really, until Stevenson went down. And now he's ripping off two long touchdowns, looks like an absolute superstar. Do you think Travion Henderson is going to keep this role moving forward?
I'd be surprised if he's starting running back for the Patriots once Ramondre Stevenson is back healthy, which could be as soon as Thursday night against the Jets. One of the areas in which Stevenson, I think the Patriots believe, is stronger than Henderson is just running between the tackles. The end of the first half sequence we saw from New England, I thought it was an incredible, just like, game within the game moment. Mike Vrabel, the Patriots have the ball, I think a minute and 40 or so left. And they opt to, even though they've denied it, or at least Drake May denied it after the fact, they opt to basically eat first and goal from the one in exchange for 40 seconds being taken off the clock. Drake May received the snap and just kind of kneeled over. He says, you know, Vita Vea was in his way, which is true. Vita Vea is a big boy and he is a one-man wrecking crew. But the Patriots did not run the football effectively on the subsequent two opportunities, first and goal from the one. That's an advantage that Stevenson has. But Henderson, no doubt, is the player who gives them so much more instant offense. And, you know, in some ways, the difference between winning and losing last week was that instant offense, right? Those two big runs are plays that, if they don't happen, that game might have been swung the other way. And I do think that, at the very least, Travion Henderson has bought himself a larger role when Ramondre Stevenson is on the field compared to where it was just prior to Ramondre's toe injury. There was a game he played 14 snaps. I think it's maybe this is not 50-50, but if you told me it was closer to like 55-45 or 60-40 in favor of Stevenson, that wouldn't surprise me.
I mean, so in other words, both those guys are going to be playable for people down the stretch in their fantasy seasons. And maybe Henderson, they ride a hot hand. No, you're not so sure?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Henderson, you know, if you're playing 45% of the snaps, like, you're going to have to get fortunate either in the big play department or the receiving department. The good news for Henderson is that he can do both of those things, right? That's the value in Travion Henderson, is that 14 carries for 147 yards this past week. But what was that, 2 carries for 124 of those 47 yards. So he can definitely, maybe it's 114. My math on the fly was
it was a lot, however many it was. And on that second touchdown as well, like Tonga, did you see the block he had?
He took down
4 guys. He had a big first block, rolled over, knocked over like 4 to 5 guys. It looked like a bowling ball.
It was incredible. Amazing.
Vrabel, of course, the player back in the day with the Patriots, caught touchdown passes. He's got to reward Tonga at some point with a touchdown opportunity.
He'll get his at some point. You know, like that's something that Vrabel's always, he's just been so good at making sure his guys stay happy. So yeah, he's a star. He is, really just an exceptional head coach. The Patriots have something very, very good to stay here right now.
All right, so the Patriots are 8-2. They've beaten the Bills already this year. Number two of our 6 points here. Are you burying the Bills as Super Bowl contenders following their horrible loss to the Dolphins? Yeah. They've lost 3 of 5. They beat the Chiefs, but they lose to the Patriots, the Falcons, and the Dolphins, and the Bills face the Bucks on this Sunday. Are you burying the Bills in their Super Bowl hopes field?
Not burying them, but the Bills have some vulnerabilities. They have two very, very specific vulnerabilities, and the beauty of the NFL, or perhaps the curse of the NFL for some teams, is that it's any given Sunday come the playoffs, right? I mean, it's any given Sunday every week, but the playoffs, if you don't bring your best, doesn't matter if you're the best roster, the worst roster to get in, you can find a way. For Buffalo, it's very clear that this team cannot defend the run. 174 rushing yards to Devon Achane this past Sunday. They have been eaten alive by running backs throughout the year. We have seen Rico Dowdle run all over. That's an error there. Rico Dowdle at that time and Chuba Hubbard were kind of splitting carries. We saw Derrick Henry all the way back in week one. We saw Bijan have a big game against them when they played on Monday Night Football. This past week, we did see another big game for Devon Achane, who's a great player, by the way. But the Bills have real run defense struggles. And then on offense, I think that there is, and obviously, of course, KOC, many people know you for your outstanding basketball acumen. Sometimes you just need a guy who can get a bucket, right? You're down 2 late in the game, and it's not about the play. It's not about who's defending you. It's who can you hand the ball to and expect points. The Bills have a lack of a pass catcher who 3rd and 7, 3rd and gotta have it, red zone opportunity, whatever it might be. Josh Allen just says, I don't care what the coverage is. I don't care if this guy is playing hurt. I don't care if this guy's 100%. I don't care what's going on right now. Who is the player that when Josh has everything stacked against him, he says, that's fine. I'm just going to throw it the direction of insert blank, and that player will make a play for him. The Chiefs have that in Rashee Rice. Maybe we're seeing that right now with the Patriots and Stephon Diggs. Obviously, Puka Nacua for the Rams and Jackson Smith and Jigba for the Seahawks. I'm just thinking about the teams at the very top of the heap. Amon-Ra St. Brown for the Lions. They don't have that right now in Buffalo. And this past week, if you look at Josh Allen's time to throw, it was very high, which usually correlates with the quarterback who can have a big day. He threw for 306 yards, but drops, inability to get open against man coverage, those have been problems for that Bills offense for a lot of this season.
I mean, you mentioned his time to throw. I saw that it's the highest it's been since 2018, so he's getting time in the pocket to throw it. But then you look at the receivers, aside from Coleman, Kincaid, those guys are not high performers. And there was a report, I think, from NFL Network that they had an offer for Waddle, of course, who they just lost to the Dolphins, and it was a 3rd-round pick in 2026 and a 1st-round pick in 2027. The Dolphins won in the 2026. My question here is with the Bills, what are you waiting for? Like, why are you not giving up their 2026 1st-round pick to go get a great receiver in Waddle? Because it feels like he fits exactly the type of criteria that you're detailing that they missed. Why didn't they do that?
Well, it's interesting because if I'm Buffalo or any team in the NFL right now, I'd rather give up a 2026 first than a 2027 first. This 2026 NFL draft class, we've got a long ways to go until April 23rd in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but it is not shaping up to be a particularly strong class. There's always going to be guys that go high because you got to find players to go in the first 10 picks. So we'll talk a lot about those guys accordingly, but I think this definitely is a dynamic and play far more frequently in basketball, right? I mean, the difference between the Hawks winning the lottery a couple of years ago versus, you know, this past year and the Mavericks winning the lottery is stark, right? this 2027 draft class, on paper, long ways away, looks far better and deeper than the 2026 NFL draft class. You know, it's a hard one for the Bills, is they have a lot of really great players. They have a lot of guys that have now been extended because they deserve those contracts. They've pulled a lot of levers, though. Like, you know, at some point, it's the salary cap is a thing in the NFL. It's real. There's no exceeding it. So Buffalo has a very small margin for error. And some of those big moves that may look good on paper, there are some downside to them as well. So Buffalo has not as many tools at their disposal right now. And it could be the difference come January between them advancing to the Super Bowl and not. And to be clear, Buffalo is in that category of teams. Kansas City is obviously in this. I would argue that the Lions and the Rams are definitely, the Eagles are definitely teams that fit into this category as well, where if at the end of this season you don't make the Super Bowl, it's a failure. It just is. Baltimore is in that category too. That's the standard that those teams, because of their prior success in the past few years, that is now how they measure a season's success or failure.
I mean, it has to be the way to measure success and failure for the Bills. They have to get to the Super Bowl this year. They have to take that step forward. Moving on to the other 8-2 team. Well, the Broncos are 8-2 as well, but I'm not as quite as high on them as I am the Indianapolis Colts this year. They have Jonathan Taylor, who is undoubtedly so far the fantasy football MVP, and yet he is still third in MVP odds in reality behind Drake May, behind Matthew Stafford. Fields. There's been four running backs so far since 2000 that have won MVP. Marshall Faulk, Sean Alexander, LaDainian Tomlinson, and Adrian Peterson. Jonathan Taylor's the fantasy MVP. Why not real-life MVP for Jonathan Taylor?
All right, so for those that are maybe listening right now, you guys have a great graphic up that shows those four running backs to win the MVP since the turn of the century, 2000. 2000, 2005, 2006, and 2012. So just once in the past 20 years have we seen a running back win MVP, that being Peterson, Adrian Peterson in 2012. And that's been, that was 13 years ago. So
long time ago.
The truth about the NFL MVP is it's the best quarterback award. The offensive player of the year is going to go to best running back award, or best non-quarterback, I should say, award. Right? You know, it's a tough one because you simultaneously feel bad that it's become just basically this quarterback award. On the other hand, it's like, it kind of makes sense, right? I mean, take away, look at what this Colts team was last year. And this team made some big moves this offseason for sure. And they've made a huge one recently this season in Sauce Gardner. But the most notable change to the roster from last year to this year is clearly Daniel Jones and his presence. You know, they signed Ken Bynum in free agency. They made a few other moves as well to help beef up this team. Tyler Warren was an exceptional first round pick, but quarterbacks are the straws that stir the drink in the NFL. And love Jonathan Taylor. I do not have one of the votes. Rank choice voting is now a thing in the NFL. For those that are unfamiliar, back in the day, you would just cast one player vote. If you wanted to vote for Matthew Stafford, that was the only vote you cast. Now you would say, hey, Matthew Stafford's number one, Drake May is number two, Jonathan Taylor is number three, Patrick Mahomes is number four, and whoever else is number five. So Sam Darnold's number five. This year might be a little bit revealing because I think there's a chance that Jonathan Taylor, if this keeps up, is at least in the top three. But I would still be surprised if a running back took over a quarterback just because of the nature of the award.
I would as well. I mean, ultimately, the quarterback is the most valuable position in the NFL. So it makes sense why they thus would be the MVP. And besides, Drake May is the MVP anyway. We all know that, right, Field? We all know.
He is. As I said, the betting favorite over at ESPN Bet now. So he keeps us up. And, you know, MVPs are not, I think him and Matthew Stafford are both very compelling narratives. Yeah. The Rams have a very intriguing schedule going forward, including two matchups with the Seahawks. A 23-year-old, if the Patriots are 14-3 or something like that, or 13-4 at the end of the year, that's going to be a pretty juicy storyline. As the NFL is, you know, that's just been blessed with this embarrassment of amazing quarterbacks that can be the face or faces of the NFL. If you get to MVP in your second season in the league, then I don't care. I know Drake May would never admit as much, but you become part of the face of the NFL if that's how much success you experience in your second season.
I mean, undoubtedly.
He's so awestruck, isn't he?
Oh, Yeah, he is. It's amazing. Exactly.
I'm incredibly impressed by the young man that Drake May is. The humility and modesty that he shows is, I mean, obviously the play is incredibly encouraging, but I think the person is just as encouraging for Patriots fans going forward.
I agree. He could easily get a big head with all of us. And yet, at every single opportunity he has to have a big head, it doesn't show up at all.
Totally.
But just on the field with the level of confidence in which he's playing with. And that's where things are so exciting as a Patriots fan on and off the field. Number four here, let's stick with running backs. Should Bijan Robinson managers be worried with this recent dip he's experienced?
I wouldn't be worried. I think that, you know, in fantasy football, one of the things that we're always talking about with our producers is when we drive conversations, what's the actionable item from this, right? So I'm just going to make this up. Hey, you know, we've had three straight games of Theo Johnson with 10 or more fantasy points. All right, hey, we got a Adam, and he should be a top 12 running back, tight end going forward. You know, Bijan's on a rut right now, as you see on the screen. He hasn't had 100 yards or a touchdown or even an 18-point game over the past three. This is not one where I'm trying to sell away my shares of Bijan Robinson. I think buying low is easier said than done.
I bought low. Maybe not low. I might have paid full price, but I bought Bijan two weeks ago.
What'd you buy? Okay, well, I'm curious what you paid for him. Do you remember what you paid?
The deal may work out, may not work out. I gave up Josh Jacobs, Rondo Gadsden, Roma Dunze, and I got back also Daniels and Calvin Ridley. So I don't love it at all. I think I overpaid slightly, but I don't have a lot of faith moving forward in Odunze to be anything consistent. Gadsden, I mean, we'll see. There's a lot of weapons on the Chargers. And with Jacobs, that calf injuries are scary, man. For a running back of that age. So it's an upside swing. Daniels gets hurt. Ridley didn't get traded. And we'll see with Bijan. It's an upside
swing. Yeah, you know, you gotta pace up and get something. So exactly. To go back to the actionable content, is that there isn't really one here in Bijan. It's more, I tell people that sometimes my job in the world of fantasy football is to kind of be your your virtual therapist. Right? Like, hey, if you're frustrated about Bijan, it's okay. Like, this is a safe space to say he was totally crushing it for me for all of these weeks, and now he's been a little bit less dominant. But if you go through the full course of the season, Bijan was worth the number one or number two overall pick. It's not like anybody, at least that I saw, was sitting here saying in August, you must take Jonathan Taylor. Of the players that we were discussing at the very top of the board, most of the conversation centered around Ja'Marr Chase, Bijan Robinson, and then to a little bit lesser degree, you're talking about guys like Justin Jefferson, CeeDee Lamb, I guess Christian McCaffrey was being discussed a lot, Jahmyr Gibbs, and I would say that, you know, Bijan has been worthy of a top two pick based off the players we were realistically discussing back in August.
I think so as well. I'm not panning with Bijan. He's inevitably going to have some big performances. The fear is Algier getting a lot of those goal line opportunities. Yeah, those goal
lines. Just annoying. It's really annoying. But
they got Bijan in the slot. I mean, what are we doing here? Give it to Bijan, please. He's an amazing
receiver, but let him just run the football from the 1 yard line.
I know. All right, moving on to number five here. Is Joe Burrow a possible fantasy league winner field? We know he's supposedly targeting Thanksgiving to return.
Yep.
What are your expectations for Burrow potentially returning?
Yeah, so with Joe, don't ever count him out from coming back from an injury, not just maybe ahead of schedule, but also coming back and being as effective as he has been previously. Let's just do some of the calendar math here. So Thanksgiving is the date that Joe himself has kind of said he's targeting. That would be week 13. We're in week 11, week 12, week 13. That will be against the Ravens on Thursday night. Depending on who you have been riding the wave of Joe Burrow with, like if you have Jackson Dart, and you have the certainty of what Jackson has looked like, you probably are playing Jackson Dart in week 13, unless the Giants really rein in his rushing with Brian Daboll now being the former Giants head coach and not the active Giants head coach. But 13 is the earliest. Maybe it's 14 against Buffalo. And so then I think the question is, if you can get into the playoffs, which start at least on ESPN default settings in week 15, who do you already have in place? And are you making the playoffs because of your quarterback or along with your quarterback? If you have a guy who's just been kind of okay, but the rest of your roster is really strong, then Joe Burrow can absolutely be a league winner. We have seen him be amongst the most, if not the most, surgical passer in the NFL. It was a quiet start for Joe, actually, prior to the injury this season. But Joe at his best, which we saw for much of last year, was a guy who week in and week out was a difference maker in your lineup.
Yeah, I mean, I picked him up off of free agency before the week wrapped up just to, you know, figure things out.
There's no,
I wanted it. Yep. There's a couple QB needed DD teams in my league. I'm seeing what kind of leverage I can get here. Moving on to number six, Alec Pierce, the guy I've had in my lineup for the last couple of weeks. I feel like I was a little bit ahead on Pierce. This week looks like a top waiver pickup. Do you think Alec Pierce, as waivers are starting to thin out towards the second half, end of the year here, is Alec Pierce going to be the best wide receiver pickup remaining for the remainder of the season?
There's a chance for sure. And so let's just talk about a couple of the ways in which waivers are getting thinner, but also rosters are becoming more flexible. If you're rostering two quarterbacks and one of them is Josh Allen or some of these guys, Patrick Mahomes, like Patrick Mahomes is your starting quarterback. If you have a decent but not dominant backup QB, like, come on. Like, I would not be, I don't want to be rostering two quarterbacks, one of which is like, okay, if you have Patrick Mahomes and you got Jackson Dart, then I would definitely keep Jackson Dart and try to trade him. But quarterback backups can be dropped, defensive or kicker backups or tight ends. Like if you held Brandon Aubrey this week, right, because he was on bye and he's so good and you grabbed a second kicker, obviously say goodbye to them. So you can be a little bit more flexible with your waiver wire pickups, but a lot of the guys being added to the waiver wire right now or being considered on the waiver wire right now are injury dependent. Pierce is not that. The Colts have been throwing the ball more and perhaps playing from behind more in recent weeks, but second round pick with serious juice down the field leads the NFL in yards per reception. There's something real here. Maybe not a 10-team league starter, but definitely on the radar in 12-team or larger.
For sure. I mean, last 4 weeks, averaging 14.9 PPR points per game. That's a wide receiver 21 over that stretch. So he's performing at a high level thus far, ever since he came back from injury. And ultimately, I think you're spot on when it comes to those roster spots. If you're a great quarterback, one of the reasons why I did trade Gadsden was because I have Trey McBride. I don't really want to have that second tight end where I have to use him in that flex slot. So, you know, yeah, we'll see what happens with his injury. Hopefully he's able to come back healthy for the Chargers, but I think that's spot on if you do have a team, as Field described. Let's go for two here of our six points here, Field, with two more questions for you. Number seven, would you roll with Mac Jones or start Brock Purdy if Kyle Shanahan calls you up asking for advice on what to do moving forward?
Well, I think Brock has a higher upside as a player. I think it's very clear right now that the 49ers are going to take as long as they need to get Brock Purdy back. And what I mean by that is the risk in bringing Brock back is when he's not quite 100% with this toe is that it can go from, I'm just going to make these numbers up. I don't know these, but let's say he's at 80% right now. There's a risk in bringing him back at 80%, which is definitely good enough to get on the field, but one false step, one big hit, and he goes from 80 to 50 once again, and the clock restarts. Whereas Mac Jones is playing well enough right now, and their schedule is enough, favorable enough, that you could just keep rolling out Mac and potentially go through your bye in week 14, maybe even all the way to the playoffs or close to it, and play Mac Jones. So there's an affinity for Mac that I don't think it's any mystery Kyle Shanahan has had since before Mac Jones was even drafted back in 2021. Just listen to the players talk about Mac Jones right now. And it's clear they understand what he is doing. This past week against the 49ers, they have a costly late pick, but this is a guy who has played some dynamite football for them, been accurate, been playing within their system. He has been pretty impressive and a player that is a good reminder that, you know, sometimes quarterback infrastructure can be almost as impactful as quarterback talent itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if they had drafted Jones instead of Lance, who knows how his career would have unfolded, right? Totally. I mean, who knows? I mean, also with the 49ers, from a fantasy standpoint, Shanahan said Ricky Parasol is due back at practice this week. Do you think he's a sleeper fantasy trade target?
Yeah, it's hard with these knee, it's PCL and like that's knee instability issues. But yeah, I mean, he was awesome prior to going down. And first round pick just a year ago. The question I have is just, is this going to be a situation where he does return to the lineup and he can't make the knee injury worse, but he's also just a shell of his former self? We've seen that time and again from players where they come back and it's gutty and it's admirable, but they also just don't have it, whether it's structurally, stamina, whatever it might be, to bring it like they have been bringing it throughout the season, however long it was prior to when they first got hurt.
All right, number eight. Let's say you're in your league, you miss out on all the waivers this week. You know, week 11 waivers, you whiff. And you're looking at the free agent market right now, and you're thinking about, who can I get ahead of? Who can I pick up before waivers next week? Who do you think is the sleeper free agent waiver target this week ahead of week 11 that could be at the top of the list a week from now?
Yeah, so there's two things that do come to mind for me, or two names that come to mind. And sleepers are hard to find in the fantasy world today because there's so much coverage of it. this is a hat tip to my buddy Mike Clay, my colleague at ESPN, does an amazing job, who notes that there's just one quarterback to finish in the top 12 in each of the past 4 weeks. And that quarterback is Jacoby Brissett. Not who we probably would have imagined going into week 11. But Brissett has been really good for fantasy. He has definitely helped improve the value of Cardinals pass catchers. Marvin Harrison Jr. had a touchdown and three.
Trey McBride, baby. Let's go.
Trey McBride's been amazing. Yeah, McBride has become.
See you later, Kyler Murray. Don't come back.
Trey McBride. Yeah, I don't think that's happening this year. So you're good there. And I don't think he's ever coming back to Arizona. But Trey McBride's just been a monster. And Marvin Harrison Jr., still some like questions with the efficiency, but he's definitely been better with Jacoby Brissett. So Brissett's a name that I have on my radar. And then one more is Luther Burden for the Bears, a name that everybody probably knows because he was a very touted prospect coming out of Missouri this past year. He goes in the second round to Chicago. The Bears, and I don't think we've heard anything since you and I got on the show a little while ago, and we'll probably learn more tomorrow because I don't think Ben Johnson is speaking today, the Bears head coach. But I think there's a chance that DJ Moore is going to miss a little bit of time here with the shoulder injury. On top of that, Alameda Zaccheaus, who's been the Bears' starting wide receiver at slot, I think is on the precipice of losing snaps to Luther Burden III, who every time he touches the football, it looks great. Incredibly explosive athlete. He is one of those players that, like, you just want to get the ball in his hands. And Ben Johnson has already acknowledged this week that maybe he's one of those guys that they need to find ways to get on the field even more. So this Bears offense has been a bit up and down, but Caleb Williams had a gigantic confidence building win this past Sunday. So if they can keep things rolling offensively based off what they did last Sunday in the fourth quarter against the Giants, you might have something there in Luther Burden.
Well, we're recording this on Tuesday, which is why you mentioned Ben Johnson hasn't spoken yet. Most people who listen to this or watch this will hear it on Thursday on my podcast feed. All right. Before my league mates hear it, I'm going to get ahead of Luther Burden, especially this week. That's screwed. Cool. Garrett Wilson injured again. Alec Pierce on a bye. I'm a little thin this week at receiver. So Luther Burden,
replace the club for me. There you go.
This is a lot of fun, man. It was an honor to have you on my podcast. I appreciate you so much for joining the show today, man. But two Massachusetts boys. Would you grow up in Mass?
Lincoln is where I was born. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Brockton, Mass here.
Brockton's probably like, 40 minutes away from Lincoln, somewhere in that regard.
Something
so,
like that. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. The good old days, man. But it's always good to catch up with you. And thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much, Field. Big thank you to Tom Haberstroh and Field Yates for joining me on today's episode. Thanks to Emmy, Dakota, and Sarah for producing today's episode. Thank you to Father John Misty to the music, and I appreciate you listening to today's episode. Hope you enjoy your weekend. We'll be back on Monday. Looking forward to that one. Have a good weekend.